The word of the Lord this morning is from Hosea chapter 11, verses 1 through 11, and Galatians 4, 1 through 9. Hear the word of the Lord. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws, and I bent down to them and fed them. They shall not return to the land of Egypt, but Assyria shall be their king, because they have refused to return to me. The sword shall rage against their cities, consume the bars of their gates, and devour them because of their own counsels. My people are bent on turning away from me, and though they call out to the Most High, he shall not raise them up at all. How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Adma? How can I treat you like Zeboim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. I will not execute my burning anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not a man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come in wrath. They shall go after the Lord. He will roar like a lion. When he roars, his children shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling like birds from Egypt and like doves from the land of Assyria. And I will return them to their homes, declares the Lord. I mean that their heir, as long as he is a child, is no different from a slave, though he is the owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by his father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not God's. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and the worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
We're in the season of Advent. Advent is comprised of the four Sundays preceding Christmas Day. And it's church tradition to celebrate or to be reflective upon during the season of Advent what it means to wait for the coming of Christ. Advent, the word, means the coming of someone or someone significant. And of course, within Christian history, it's intended to refer to the place of looking forward to the arrival of Jesus Christ, both his first arrival and his second arrival. Now, the way we're doing that is a way that's not uncommon to churches to reflect upon this in this season, which is to choose an Old Testament passage which promises something. It looks forward to some kind of fulfillment. And we consider how the Old Testament people of God then had to wait for the first fulfillment, the first arrival of the Messiah. And then we go to a New Testament passage and consider how that Old Testament passage has been realized in the first coming of the Messiah. And we ask ourselves, well, how are we doing at waiting for the second coming of the Messiah? And so our passage is today from the prophet Hosea and from Paul's letter to the church in Galatia. Talk about a loving father, a father who is filled with love, who has nurtured his child and brought him up with great care and compassion. And of course, in the Old Testament, when you talk about the Son of God, you're talking about Israel. That's a title of Israel until you get to Jesus and he takes over that title. But despite all of the love and energy that God has poured into his child is remarkably wayward. Israel is always going in the wrong direction, always worshiping the wrong things. You get the sense, even in verse 1, when Israel was a child, I loved him. And out of Egypt, I called my son. the more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. So even though God in his love and compassion has moved toward Israel, Israel inevitably, consistently, repeatedly moves away from God, thinking that they can find life in something else, in something that's not a God, rather than in God himself. And the tension that we feel in the Old Testament is, how is this going to be resolved? This loving parent who doesn't know what to do with this child who is always rebellious. Of course, in this sense, in our passage in Hosea, Israel, in one sense, is exiled out of the family. Almost booted out of the home is the sense of exile. But God promises that won't be the end of the story. And even though exiled or booted out of their home, what do we see in Galatians? That God makes sure that he can adopt his children. So children that are disciplined out of the home are adopted back into the home in love because God has brought everything to completion in Jesus Christ. And so one of the themes that should impress us this morning is the remarkable love of God. The love of God that so exceeds even our constant rebellion and our constant desire to worship anything other than him. He continually runs after us and pursues us passionately. Love is essential. In fact, I think it's much more important than often we acknowledge or we realize in our own lives. We sometimes like to pretend we're strong and don't always need that abundant love of a parent. In 1990, the Romanian Revolution occurred. And in 90, Nicolae Ceausescu was the then communist dictator who was put to death in the revolution. He had ruled Romania as a dictator for really a quarter of a century. And when his rule came to an end, the West was invited in. Romania needed an incredible amount of help. It was in a desperate place. And so the West began to realize what had been happening behind the Iron Curtain in Romania and discovered that there were what came to be called child gulags. Some 170,000 children were living in state-run institutions. The reason for that is Ceausescu, during his reign, decided that the way to promote the Romanian economy was for Romanians to have as many children as they possibly could. And so he put different laws in place. Contraception was curtailed. Women who had 10 or more children were called heroin mothers, right? Not heroin the drug, but as in hero. Hero mothers for bearing so many children. If you didn't have children, you were taxed for not bearing children. And so the population swelled incredibly, and it swelled too much and too fast so that people couldn't take care of the children, and they were overwhelmed with the number of youth in society. And so, very sadly, as families were overwhelmed, some children began to be abandoned. Well, Ceausescu didn't rethink his platform. He said, that's fine, we'll take care of these children. Take care being a very generous term. And he began to build hundreds of institutions that would basically just be warehouses that provided the bare essentials for children in Romania. You would get a bottle in your mouth leaned against the side of the crib. You would be changed periodically, but these children enjoyed basically no human interaction while they sat in and grew up in these institutional homes, each which bore a sign that said, the state can take better care of your children than you can. Well, as I said, in 1990, Romania was opened up, and the West came into the country and was overwhelmed by what they were seeing, because they would go in these institutions, and the children were essentially no longer human beings. They had suffered such dramatic mental scars and physical scars that they were reduced to something that was kind of a shadow of a human being. And it made people think of attachment theory. Attachment theory is something that had been in the world of psychology, but kind of relegated to the world of soft science. Harry Harlow was a famous psychologist who did experiments about the middle of the last century with rhesus monkeys, and he would take infant rhesus monkeys away from their mothers and then raise them with wire and cloth pretend moms, right, surrogates, to observe if the bond between a mother and a child was important. Well, it was severely to the detriment of the rhesus monkeys, who often demonstrated really very broken and desperate mental defects as a result of not being attached to their mother, not receiving the care and love from a provider. Well, this all came to the fore, you can imagine, right? Formerly, this had been only theorized in the world of monkeys, and suddenly there was this new population of children that had grown up with no bond to a parent and not having received any love. And so there was a scientific gathering in 1998, and one of the presenters showed a video of the Romanian children and what they were suffering in the gulags and the mental issues, the mental illness they were dealing with, rocking back and forth, banging their heads against the wall and squawking. And then immediately afterwards, he showed a video of Harlow's rhesus monkeys who were swaying and twirling and self-mutilating. And a person who was at the gathering said everyone was completely reduced to tears because the video of the children in Romania and the video of the rhesus monkeys was so profoundly similar, right? Which suddenly led to all kinds of research on attachment theory, which is pretty established at this point, the notion being that human beings desperately, profoundly need love. A human being can't actually survive without receiving some kind of love from a caregiver. Now, I would take that even further in the sense that if we are created by God and ultimately intended to be shaped and formed and made whole by His love, then to the degree that we don't participate in that love or lack that love, we have an inability, right, to truly be human, to truly be whole. Now, love is essential humanly, but it's even more essential when we think about our relationship with God. Now, the irony here between the illustration I've just given you and the reality of the scriptures we're talking about today is that in the illustration, the parents were removed from the children. But for us, the biblical story is what? We remove ourselves from the parent. Right? We run away from the love that God is offering. God isn't withdrawing His love simply because of some circumstance. And so we consider the love of the Heavenly Father who will not take no for an answer this morning. And in considering that love, we have to wrestle too with our tendency to run away from that love, which is crazy. You can sit and think about it and you will come to the conclusion that it is perhaps the most illogical or rational decision that human beings ever make. And yet any of us on any given week can take a survey of what we've been engaged in and the things that have really gotten all of our time and our money and our energy, which are the currencies of love, right? You can't say you love something if all your time, money, and energy goes to something else. If we take a survey of that, we realize, oh, indeed, right? In some ways, we're very much like Israel, and we're still running to the Baals and making all kinds of offerings. So the way I'd like to break it up this morning is, number one, back to Egypt. Number two, adoption. Number three, loving not gods. I don't think that's grammatically correct, but it's a line out of Paul's letter, and so that's the point. Back to Egypt, adoption, and loving not gods. First, back to Egypt. This passage in Hosea proceeds essentially through four different sections as God reflects on His love and Israel's disobedience. In verses 1-4, God talks about His love in growing up Israel and leading them out of Egypt. And if you just skim with me 1-4, you can see all the I statements that refer to God's love as it was exhibited in His parenting of Israel. I loved him. I called. I taught. And when you see Ephraim there, Ephraim, there's no reason you should remember, Ephraim is one of Joseph's sons. But at this point in Israel's history, it became a nickname for Israel. Like you might say America or the United States, you could say Israel or you could say Ephraim and refer to the nation. I took them up by their arms. I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness. I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws. I bent down to them and fed them. So you have this overwhelming sense in the opening that God is saying, I have done everything to nurture the child Israel, rescuing them out of bondage and investing in them, nourishing them, building them up. And yet, in verses 5-7, God says, but actually, I must return them to Egypt, which is a metaphor. They're not literally going back to Egypt. They're actually going to go into exile under Assyria. But it's the same idea. Just like you were in bondage under the Egyptians, now you're going to be in bondage under the Assyrians. Now, why has God changed His tune after investing so much in bringing up Israel the child? Well, God tells you in verse 5, because they have refused to return to me. Israel will not pay him any heed. And in verse 7, my people are bent on turning away from me. So despite all of God's love and the promise of the best life that Israel can have in the midst of relationship with him, Israel continues to turn in a different direction. Right? Their hearts cannot love what loves them the best. Now, interestingly and beautifully, in verses 8 and 9, God laments what he has to do. Right? Boys and girls, I know you hate this phrase, but have you ever heard your parents say, what I'm about to do hurts me more than it hurts you? Right? And you roll your eyes and think, that can't possibly be true. But this is really the sense of what God is saying. Like, what I have to do to you, Israel, is not what I want to do. And I don't take pleasure in it. It actually hurts my heart to do it. He laments what he has to do. If you look at verse 8, how can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboiim? Both of those were cities that were utterly destroyed because they were next to Sodom and Gomorrah. And so God is saying, how can I lay utter waste to you? How could I level you? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. It's hard to capture how passionate and emotionally charged that last phrase is in the Hebrew, from the Hebrew to the English. It's really, it's more like all of my compassion grows warm and tender. Like everything that I have to offer in terms of love and compassion toward you is raised in the sense of when I have to think about disciplining you in this fashion. And so God's compassion is great, but we feel this tension. Israel just won't reform. And God has to take their lack of obedience seriously in terms of his holiness and justice. If he starts compromising, then there's no holiness and justice left. And so he has to discipline Israel, but he laments that fact. But in verses 10 through 11, you have a vision that this is not the end of the story. God will not ultimately execute all of his burning anger. Why? Because God is God and not a man. Eventually, he will roar like a lion, and you might think of the lion of the tribe of Judah. And when that happens, his people will return home. Those who have been kicked out of the house get to come back to the house. We might say, how in the world can this be? If you think about it for a moment, how could this possibly come about? It seems that Israel is not willing to change. And if Israel is not willing to change or incapable of changing, then they're always going to need to be disciplined. And if God is holy and just and Israel is never reforming, then God is always going to have to be the disciplinarian. And we're in a situation that has no endpoint, that has no resolution. Like, how will this ultimately be resolved so that God can actually say, yes, my people are welcome to come home and to stay at home and not to fear exile again? This, friends, is the Kobayashi Maru. Now, if you're not a Star Trek fan, you may miss this illustration or not be aware of it, but one of the great parts of Star Trek is when, to all Starfleet cadets, they are presented the Kobayashi Maru, which is a no-win scenario. Right? You've got your ship. There's a ship under attack. You're tasked with rescuing the crew of the ship. The Klingons are attacking the ship. You have a choice to make. You can rescue the crew and beam them aboard your ship, and you all get destroyed. Or you can fight the Klingons and destroy the Klingons, but they're going to destroy the broken-down ship with its crew before you can save them. Either way, you either lose one crew or both crews. Right? And so, of course, James Kirk cheats. In order to get through the Kobayashi Maru and become the character that he is, he reprograms it so that you can actually save the crew and defeat the Klingons. It makes him who he is. But this is the situation in the Old Testament. It's a no-win scenario, right? Either Israel has to change, which he can't, or God has to change, which he can't. And you're at an impasse. And so the reason I bring that up is for you to put yourselves just for a moment in the shoes of the Israelites, looking forward to these promises. And what is God going to do? Waiting for something to happen in which this great tension is relieved in a very profound way, which they could not foresee, right? Never forget, nobody recognizes Jesus when he shows up. There's not one sect of Judaism that gets it right. And yet they wait. They wait. I mean, they wait and they sin and they repent and they keep going down this road. And it makes us long for some kind of serious resolution, which of course comes in the incarnation, and Paul unpacks for us in our passage in Galatians. And this brings us to our second point, which is that of adoption. The point here that Paul is making in Galatians 4 is that, you know, if you think about kids growing up in a Greco-Roman household in the first century, it says there's really no difference between the slave and the heir. The heir, who's said to inherit everything, doesn't have any rights and privileges as a child running around the house. They're under guardians, they're under managers, they're being tutored, but they don't have the ability to cash in on their status because of where they are in their development, in their maturing process. And ultimately, their rights and privileges are not much different than that of a slave in the same household. And in this sense, Paul will say in verse 3 that this status is equivalent to being enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. Right? That even Israel, even as the law is giving some degree of life to Israel in the Old Testament, the reality is that Israel, just like everyone else, is trapped according to the elementary principles of this world. They can't not sin. All they can do is operate by their own versions of power and strength and winning and success and what it means to have a full life. They keep returning to those rather than actually having a life that is abundant, that transcends that and is informed by God's agenda. Paul in Galatians will actually call the law a pedagogue, a teacher during this time. That the law functioned in the life of Israel as a training curriculum, so to speak, for Israel to recognize and to understand their sin so that they could be prepared for something to happen. Something to happen in verse 4, which is a phrase only Paul uses, in the fullness of time, which is beautiful. That God has simply been waiting. Everything has been providential. The clock's been ticking. And when it gets to a certain point in time in history, the fullness of time has been reached, and it's time to execute the plan of the Messiah. You see, the fullness of time, and then in 5, for what? To redeem those who are under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. That those who stand in this impossible tension, where they can't reform and God's not going to change, ultimately get redeemed. Right? They could become adopted as sons and daughters of the living God. Now, of course, this adoption happens in the person of Christ because Jesus assumes the role of Israel, right? Over and over again, with too many examples that we could mention this morning, Jesus assumes the mantle of Israel and becomes the Son of God that Israel was intended to be. And he lives the life of perfect obedience and yet bears the curse of the law on the cross, which essentially blows it up, right? And redeems those who are unified to him by faith, that we might be adopted as sons and daughters. Well, what is that benefit of adoption? One benefit is that we're no longer alienated from God. Now, you've already seen in Hosea that the position, the only position somebody can really hold for the most part, is to be in this place between obedience and sin and this endless cycle. You can think of like a paragon of holiness in the Old Testament like Moses. And still, what's the end of Moses' story? He doesn't go to go in the promised land, right? Because he can't obey despite himself. And no longer do we live in this place where we can't help but sin, but now being redeemed and having the Spirit and being sons and daughters, we have the opportunity not to sin. Is that still difficult? Absolutely. But we have an opportunity that the Old Testament people of God never had, right? Now possessing the Spirit of God and being established permanently in the household of God. Sin doesn't stand in the same way of our relationship because we're not managing sin constantly through a sacrifice at a temple, but the one true sacrifice has been made once for all. And so now, right, we have a relationship of intimacy, which is why Paul can say, now our relationship with God is Abba, Father. Abba is the Aramaic for daddy, right? Which is something that you would never see uttered in that fashion in the Old Testament because that degree of intimacy was never found until we're adopted into God's household and now cry out to him, Daddy. The no-win scenario has been trumped by the incarnation, which is a pretty wonderful present, if you think about it. Part of that makes me feel a little bit guilty when I get excited about presents under the tree. What present compares with the present of the incarnation? I've always said this, and I've never done it. I think it'd be really beautiful to celebrate a Christmas in which there were no presents, in which everyone just kind of celebrated and rejoiced the gift of the incarnation. I think that might come a little bit closer to the notion of what we need to celebrate rather than the Christmases we sometimes do celebrate. Well, how do we wait well as sons and daughters, right? We've said the whole point of Advent is to reflect upon our own waiting. And this brings us to point three, which is loving not gods. If you look at 8 and 9 in Galatians, Paul issues a warning. Even though, remember, adoption has occurred. People are sons and daughters. But formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. By now that you have come to know God, but now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of this world, whose slaves you want to be once more? You know, Paul marvels at the Galatians. He says, listen, you've been rescued by the living God. You've been made sons and daughters and now given the privilege of calling him Abba and running to him in the Spirit, being unified to the Trinity itself. And what do, Galatians? You return to the things that are not gods and worship them. You return to the elementary principles of this world. You return to the things that you knew and are comfortable with rather than waking up to your new life, rather than truly being made new. It reminds us that in some ways, a dog all too often returns to its own vomit. In 1978, Russian geologists were flying over Siberia. Most of Russia's mineral resources actually come from the great Siberian tundra. So they were in a helicopter in a very remote location of the Siberian forest, about 100 miles south of Mongolia, and they were tasked with setting up a geology camp in that vicinity to do mining and oring exploration. And they're flying. The forest is so dense they can't even find a place to land. Until suddenly they come upon about 6,000 square feet that have been cleared. And what's really odd is there are furrows running along the ground. And so the people in the helicopter said, this really can't be, but that looks a lot like a garden. And so eventually the helicopter finds a place to land and the scientists who are setting up camp, but they're all eager to go kind of explore this garden. And they explore the garden, and it is a garden. And they begin investigating the vicinity of the garden and eventually find a small cabin, very rudimentary. Don't think like any log cabin you might. Think of if somebody threw a bunch of logs that they hand cut together and made something of a shack. This is what they find sitting next to a stream in the middle of nowhere. If there was ever an unexplored, unpopulated frontier left on Earth, this would qualify as one of those places. And it's shocking because it's 150 miles from the nearest settlement. And so they begin to approach the cabin, and this is the first encounter as described by one of the scientists. Blackened by time and rain, the hut was piled up on all sides with Siberian rubbish, bark, poles, planks. If it hadn't been for a window the size of my backpack pocket, it would have been hard to believe that people lived there. But they did, no doubt about it. Our arrival had been noticed, as we could see. The low door creaked, and the figure of a very old man emerged into the light of day, straight out of a fairy tale. Barefoot, wearing a patched and repatched shirt made of sacking, he wore trousers of the same material, also in patches, and had an uncombed beard. His hair was disheveled. He looked frightened and was very attentive. We had to say something, so I began, "Greetings, grandfather. We've come to visit." The old man did not reply immediately. Finally, we heard a soft, uncertain voice. "Well, since you have traveled this far, you might as well come in." And the scientists did come in. They began to build a relationship with a family that had been living in the middle of nowhere for over 40 years. What had happened was this. The man's name was Karp Lykov. And Karp Lykov was what is in Russia called an old believer, which is something like a Russian Orthodox fundamentalist, somebody very serious and committed to practicing Russian Orthodoxy, as it's been practiced for really since the 1600s. When the Bolshevik Revolution happened in the 1920s, which was an atheist revolution, they began to persecute Russian Orthodoxy and particularly the more fundamentalist sects, to the point that one day Karp is out kneeling and working with his brother on their land, and a communist patrol party comes by and shot his brother. And so Karp scooped up his family, they packed what they could carry, and they marched into the Siberian wilderness sometime in the early 1930s. This is 1978. They've had no human contact whatsoever since the day that they left. They went into the forest with two kids and would have two more kids in the forest. Now, what's interesting is what happens to a family, right, cut off from civilization utterly for that amount of time, for 40 years. Well, several things happened. They, of course, lost all civilization. Their teeth were rotting and falling out. They had poor diets. They could only eat what they grew. They were filthy. They didn't practice normal hygiene. And interestingly, their language had deconstructed. So apparently, particularly the children who were born in the forest spoke their own kind of language, which the scientists described as basically sounding like cooing to one another. But they didn't wholly adopt the tongue that the father knew. And even that, the father, himself, Lion, was the only one who spoke the old Russian and could really dialogue in that fashion after so many years. And so, in the sense, this family has been exiled, right? They've run, they've suffered persecution, and they made the decision to exile themselves far in the wilderness and to live alone, right, unto themselves, and they thought that that was safety. But times have changed now, circumstances have changed, and the scientists come, and they bear all kinds of technology that the family can't even fathom. It's like being transported 50 years into the future with no knowledge of what's happened or what's developed. And so a relationship is built, which happens over time, and repeatedly the invitation is to come out of the forest. They would tell the family, you've actually got relatives who have survived the persecution of the 30s living in the same villages that you were from. Would you like to go back? And we can offer health care and help you get reestablished. And the family continually says, no, we want to stay right where we are. Eventually, the family starts dying off, and eventually the geologist's job is done, and they're leaving, and there's only one daughter left, the youngest daughter. And they plead with her to come with them, and she says, no, I'm going to stay right here. It's hard for me to imagine. I mean, who can imagine what would it be like to be cut off from civilization for that period of time, right? But if we take a step back and take a little bit of a landscape view of what's happening, this family is exiled, and when they have the opportunity to go home, they don't want to go home because they're afraid. They don't want to go home because they don't know what life is going to be like, and they don't want to embrace it, and they've been so secure in this little bubble for such a significant period of time. This is exactly what Paul is saying, right, to the Galatian church, right, that God has brought you home from exile. You've been adopted as sons and daughters. The robe has been thrown on you. The signet ring has been placed on your finger. Sandals have been placed on your feet. And what are some in the Galatian church doing? They're saying thanks, but no thanks. We prefer the forest. We want to live the way that we've been living, and we don't want to come back home. And that's the challenge for you, and it's the challenge for me. That in the midst of God's adoption, we have a tendency to run backwards, right? To things that we know, things that are familiar, things that we believe have brought us security and a sense of peace since our early childhood, since our personalities have been formed and we've reached for things to help us navigate this world. And God says, no, I will save you. I will rescue that from those elementary principles of this world and give you a life that is new. It's not attached to, it's not defined by, it doesn't depend upon those elementary principles. And it's up to you and I to whether we say, okay, I'm brave enough to venture back home and live in that kingdom. Or to say, you know, I really find it comfortable what I know. And I'm a little bit scared to move into new life. And we know in our heads and our minds that new life, right, is everything that the kingdom is about. Right? John makes it clear that Christ has come not only to assure some eternal destination, but that you and I would enjoy abundant life in the here and now. Abundant life began at the resurrection of Jesus Christ. It does not begin in heaven. And yet to the degree that we pull back and we want to run back to exile, right? We prefer the elementary principles of this world and the things that are not God to God himself. So take stock this morning. Even as you come to the table, be reminded that this bread and this wine, what is it? It's the love of a father. It's the love of a father who would not take no for an answer and has pursued you to the end of the earth that you might be redeemed. Right? Why would you not come home from exile? Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your great grace, and we thank you that you are a passionate father that runs after a most disobedient child. And even as we hear in this world the stories of parents who struggle with that reality in their own homes, let us both marvel at their love, but marvel even more at your love, seeing how difficult it is, seeing how even you lament the things that you have to do in order to bring the story to its proper conclusion. We thank you and praise you that we are adopted as sons and daughters, and we cry out to you this morning, even as you have instructed us, Abba, Father, Daddy. We thank you that you've scooped us up in your arms, that you've given us the best of everything. Would you help us to grow in wisdom and in stature and not to be so foolish as to return to those things that are not God's, to return to those things that are the elementary principles of this world, but instead to celebrate the adoption that is ours. We give you thanks in Christ's name. Amen.